Okay, so first of all, who are you and what are you doing here in Vancouver?
So my name is Janice Abbott. I'm the CEO of Atira. Guess what I'm doing here in Vancouver, as well as living.
And you came from the organization Atira, so we are here right now. And can you tell me who you are and what they're doing? What's their mission?
Sure. So Atira Women's Resource Society is a women's anti-violence organization. Our vision is to build a world free of inequalities where everyone's human rights are respected and where women and girls have the right to participate fully and effectively in all of the decisions that affect their lives. We manifest our mandate primarily through housing, although we do a whole bunch of other things as well, from daycare centers to legal advocacy programs to stopping the violence, counseling, outreach. So in addition to building and providing housing to women and children, and in particular women who have experienced violence, we also have support programs.
And how did you get involved?
So I've been here almost 31 years. And like many women who do women's anti-violence work, I come from lived expertise. So most of us here, that's what drives our passion to do this work.
Yeah, amazing work. And one of your biggest projects is women in housing, as you already mentioned. How's the situation of women's housing in Canada right now?
The situation for housing for everybody in Canada is obviously at a crisis point, because we don't have enough housing. Rent is high. It's particularly acute in cities like Vancouver and Toronto. Vancouver especially, we've seen I think 56% increase in rents in the last 3 years. I think a one-bedroom apartment in Vancouver right now goes for about $2,600 a month. We haven't seen anywhere near the same corresponding increases in people's wages. For women and children, especially women-led households, we know that women make less money than men. We know that women of color, women who are racialized, make less money than white women. We know that most single-parent families are led by women. So when you consider all of those factors, it's not hard to arrive at the conclusion that when there's a housing crisis, women and children are disproportionately affected.
And how do you support these women?
From Atira's perspective, one of the things Atira does is build housing in as much as we can as a nonprofit organization and relying obviously on government programs. One of the things we're doing at the Pan-Canadian Voice for Women's Housing, which Atira is a part of, is advocating for government to include consideration for women and children in their housing policies. So some of the things, for example, are building units that have more than one bedroom or they're big enough to accommodate families. We would like to see units in places where women and children want to live, so close to public amenities, schools, grocery stores, that kind of stuff. We would like to see units set aside for women, not only housing developments that are led for and by women, but also set asides in housing developments for women and children as well. We want units to consider the possibility or that women who are disabled have children and women have children who are disabled, so we need to consider units that are accessible for women and children and big enough for women and children and in places. And so we want to see government develop policies that take all of that into consideration.
And could you explain what Pan-Canadian Voice for Women's Housing stands for?
Yeah, so the Pan-Canadian Voice for Women's Housing is a cross-Canada network of women and women-serving agencies, almost all of us doing housing wherever we are in the country. So we have members from Newfoundland, from Nunavut, and the Northwest Territories, the Yukon, every province across Canada. And our goal is to find the things that unite us, because although the regions of Canada are diverse and we all face different challenges depending on where we are. Like, the challenges are way different for housing in the north, for example, than they are than they are in the south, and they're way different if you're living in a remote or rural community than if you're living in an urban community. So we recognize there's vast differences, but we also recognize that there's lots of things we have in common, including the struggle for more housing for women. And so the goal is to come together and advocate together, to have the federal government include policies that positively affect women and children, housing policies that positively affect women and children, but also to lend a voice to each other in all of our, in all of the unique challenges we have depending where we are in the country, and also to train women and provide education. So how do you write a letter to the editor? How do you advocate with your provincial, federal, municipal politicians? How do you get the media interested in the subject? How do you talk with one another? So it's really about building capacity in the women's housing sector across the country to advocate for change.
How can people like me support this woman too? Because not only shelters or women centers support women, but how can I as a person support those women?
So going into our website and signing on to our calls for action. So we have 6 calls for action that address some of the changes we'd like to see in housing policy to affect women. It's going out to public hearings in your communities when there's affordable housing developments being considered, and writing letters to politicians, writing letters and at every level, so municipal, provincial, and federal, encouraging more funding for housing. You know, we have to really think about the fact that there is going to be a ton of immigration into Canada. We don't have enough housing for the people who live here already, so what's going to happen to the immigrants as they come to Canada, particularly when we see refugees? Again, a lot of women-headed families. So we need all of our voices showing up at public hearings, showing up at rallies, supporting our calls to action, writing letters to their MLAs and MPs, and just really using our voices as loudly and as clearly as we can to advocate for housing. Mm-hmm. For women.
Yes, yeah. For sure. And we'll link your website on our archive so that people can check it out. And yeah, we were talking about housing and housing policies. So how are the housing policies for First Nation, Métis, and Inuit women different to white women's housing? Is there a difference?
Well, because of the history of colonization, genocide in Canada, we know that Indigenous women, so First Nations, Métis, Inuit women and children, women in particular, are more likely to be victims of violence. They're more likely to be victims of murder. They're more likely to be unhoused. So as acute as the housing situation is for white women or for people in Canada, it's that much more acute for First Nations, Métis, and Inuk women and children. And part of what we're calling for, the Pan-Canadian Voice for Housing, is a carve-out or a set-aside for housing for First Nations, Métis, and Inuk women that's led by First Nations, Métis, and Inuk women. When we build programs or housing or advocate for ourselves, it has to be led by us. So we really like to see a policy that allows First Nations, Métis, and Inuk women and children from across the country to develop and build their own housing that works for them and is that's meaningful to them.
Yes, that makes total sense. And we came here together to talk about the budget of 2023 for women in housing in general. And how do you want to spend this budget, and what is this budget about?
So we're talking about the federal budget?
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this federal budget didn't see a huge amount of money for housing, and so our primary focus, in addition, as a network of women's organizations across the country, in addition, raising our voices and making sure there's more money for housing, and in particular for women's housing, in the next budget, and to advocate to reconsider and add more funding this year, we will be asking that the money that is available, that there are considerations that benefit women and children, so that whatever there is this year, that there's more housing built for women and children. But the reality is this budget didn't allow for a lot of additional money for housing, so it was a disappointing budget for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why we have to continue talking about it.
Yes.
So important. And what are your main goals for this year, 2023, besides the budget?
Yeah, so the Pan-Canadian Voice for Women Housing, we'll hold our annual symposium in October. That's being held in Ottawa, so we'll bring women from across the country together to review our calls for action, see if they need to be updated or added to. I'd like to say we can delete some, but we can't because they're all still relevant. So we may massage them, or we may add to them. We will continue to offer training and support to women to build capacity so they can be loud advocates for housing wherever they live across the country. We will continue to meet virtually and strategize about how we can impact stories in the media, influence politicians, influence other organizations, just to continue to drive forth this message that we need housing for women and kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what has improved over the years? So you probably have seen so many things in your work here, during your work here, and where do you still see room for improvement when it comes to women's in housing?
Well, unfortunately, I've seen things like I could not have anticipated 31 years ago how bad the housing crisis would be today. So well, certainly there have been things that have improved for women in the 31 years that I've been doing this work. There are a lot of things that are worse than they were 31 years ago. The housing prices, wages, all of those things have deteriorated over the last 31 years. And so instead of, you know, what has gotten better, tragically, things have actually gotten worse when it comes to housing for everyone, and that, of course, disproportionately negatively affects women and kids.
Mm-hmm. But what has improved so far? I see the problem here. It's worse.
When it comes to housing, which is what the Pan-Canadian Voice for Women's Housing is about, things have actually deteriorated. And that's it's deteriorated for everybody. There's no surprise to anybody. There's a housing crisis in this country, or there's a housing crisis and there's an income crisis. Like some people might argue it's not actually housing, it's income. It's income inequality, right? But yeah, it's definitely gotten worse.
Yeah, that's very sad to hear. But
The other thing we can say too is, and there's lots of folks that believe there's a connection between this data and the pandemic, but in fact, there's been more women murdered by their partners in the last couple of years than in recent history.
I heard that too. Yeah. That femicide is getting worse and worse every year, and I would come to the end, almost the end here. Why are so many women, children, and gender diverse people turned away by shelters, and how can we prevent that?
So the short answer is it's because there's not enough shelters or not enough shelter beds. The longer answer is that should we be exploring whether shelter beds are the best use of funding? Would it be better to build long-term housing? Shelter beds are short-term. They certainly work when women are in crisis, but they also create anxiety because they're short-term. And right now, women don't know where they're going to go after the shelter stay runs out. So I think that, the easy answer, that sort of easiest answer is, well, we need to build more shelter beds, but then the question becomes, what's the best use of the limited funding? And should we be spending more money on shelters, or should we be spending more money on building long-term permanent housing so that women have housing options and don't have to go to shelters in the first place? Because there's definitely women who stay in violent abusive relationships because they have nowhere to go.
We are almost at the end of this interview, so do you have anything to add that I have missed asking about, or that would you like to add?
I don't think so. I think you had a pretty comprehensive list of questions there, and you gave me lots of leeway, so I can't think of anything I've missed.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dennis, for this interview. And I have one last question. Do you have a song that inspires you, gives you power?
People you've never heard of, like Tracy, I can't remember this, Fast Car. So that might be one, or God, I need more time.
It's
Give me
a
time.
Tricky question. Yeah, you can
email. Can I email you
a
few ideas?
Yeah, for sure. No worries, no stress. Yeah, thank you so much, Dennis, for this interview. And we are out here.
This is Bird Note. When a pair of Western Grebes decides it's time to mate, it's as if they know they have an audience for the performance they're about to give. On the still waters of an alkaline lake, they call loudly and approach one another. Each bird curves, then straightens its long neck gracefully. They then face each other, necks on the water's surface, their bills flipping up drops of water. If attraction prevails, they rush together and off they go across the water, running on the surface side by side. Standing straight up with necks held high and feet churning like propellers, they no longer look much like grebes, more like participants in Tchaikovsky's ballet Swan Lake. After their lengthy pas de deux, with wings extended like parallel sails, they plunge below the surface. What follows is the weed ceremony, each bird diving to pick up a beakful of soft vegetation. The grebes then stand up in the water, face one another, press tightly together, then drop the plants and preen. The whole courtship sequence may begin again at any time, building in intensity as spring progresses and the pair makes ready to start a new generation. You can see a video of the Western Grebes mating dance at birdnote.org.
Let's go. We can start. Can you say something just for a quick test?
Hi, my name is Caitlin, and I'm getting over a cold.
Yes. Okay, perfect. And hopefully you get better soon.
Thank you.
Okay, so we can start. So we are CWSF and my name is Vivian, and today I have a special guest. I have Dr. Caitlin Mudry. Is this how you pronounce your name? Mudry. And could you introduce yourself to the listeners, and yeah, what are you doing here in BC?
For sure. I'm a naturopathic doctor, and I do a lot of primary care for my patients in Kimberley, BC. I also am a new mom. So I have a five-month-old baby, and that has been a super fun and exciting journey, and we are very happy to be raising our baby in beautiful BC, hiking and biking and all the fun things.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations to the baby.
And, thank you.
You are a part of the Access BC team, and what is Access BC and what is their mission?
For sure. So Access BC is a campaign that has successfully succeeded in getting prescription contraception covered by the government of BC as a gender equity health initiative. And the campaign is 7 years old, and I've been working with them for the past 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And you just said that you are a postdoctoral research fellow, and can you tell me a little bit more about your own research? So what do you do?
For sure. So I do lots of just like general primary care medicine, so that you would be with your family doctor. I do a lot of PAPs and things like that. And I also did my training in the States. So mm-hmm. It's kind of funny, what brought me to Access BC was that I got my IUD at Planned Parenthood in the United States in like 2011 or something like that. And then when I got back up here, people were like, oh, you know, like, where did you get your IUD? And I was like, I don't know, I got mine for free in mm-hmm. Planned Parenthood in America. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, we don't have something like that. Like, we have options for sexual health here, which is, like, great in a lot of ways, but especially in my community that I work in, they're open only 3 hours a week. Mm-hmm. So any kind of, like, sexual health, contraception, consultation, support, questions, access, all of that is something that is desperately needed in multiple municipalities throughout Canada, but especially in BC. And so that's something that like really drew me to this cause, was helping support access. And that's how Access BC started, actually. It was when there was a big cut to funding of Planned Parenthood in the States. Mm-hmm. In Canada, we were like, oh my gosh, like, what can we do to help support Planned Parenthood? It was like, whoa, wait, we don't even have things like Planned Parenthood in Canada, and we need to be improving our options for contraception care in Canada, as well as supporting our, folks in the States as well.
Mm-hmm. So can you explain how the law was before for providing birth control?
So How it happened before, what was going on before was that vasectomies were covered, and mm-hmm. that was it.
Oh, so, okay. Wow.
I used to make a joke of, like, why aren't people getting more vasectomies? It's the only covered contraception, prescription contraception.
Yeah.
And so now, starting 2 days ago, April 1st, people can go to their doctor, get a prescription written. So this is for any kind of, like, the birth control pill, both types of IUDs, the hormonal and the copper IUD. Injections are covered, I believe. There's a couple things that aren't covered, but for most types of contraception that you need a prescription for, you just go to your doctor, get your prescription, and then you go to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy gives you your medication, and it just gets directly billed to the government. So there's no cost to anybody accessing that contraception upfront at the pharmacy, which is amazing. It even covers Plan B, which is super important.
Oh, wow. That is amazing. It's great. And what isn't covered?
So the rings aren't covered, like the NuvaRing. Patches aren't covered. And then some types of oral contraception, like Lolo. So those are kind of like these like mini pills. And this is something that the campaign is still working on for sure. So if you go to our website, accessbc.org, we still have a letter writing campaign. So part of our letter writing campaign is a thank you to all of the MLAs and people who have like brought this up to the government, who helped it get passed as a policy. Thank you so much. This is so amazing. Let's keep working on these other couple things, because for some people it is still a really important option. And that's something that I've seen a lot, like as a clinician, is that finding the right birth control for someone can kind of be a difficult process. So when you find something that works for you, you really want to be able to stick with it. And that means like it's effective for you, and it has low side effects, and it works with your body, you can remember to take it.
Oh yeah, for sure. And can you tell me, why did you want to change this law, or why did AccessBC wanted to change this law? So why it is important to change this law? What do you think?
For sure. So, like, one of the biggest things that we think of is health and health and gender equality, right? So, like I said, vasectomies were covered. It's probably because they were a surgical procedure, and most surgical procedures are covered, but when we think about that, of like what's the percentage of people who are accessing contraception and what percentage of them are people who would be getting a vasectomy, it's very, very low, right? So the current thing that we had in place was like very inequitable to anyone with a uterus needing contraception. And then also our we have like a huge white paper on our website. It's still up there, but just showing that there is tons of financial benefits to the government when contraception is paid for, because it helps prevent unwanted pregnancies. Having contraception helps with a lot of different gynecological conditions. It's actually like one of the largest prescribed things is like, oh, you have something going on, like, why don't you try an IUD? Why don't you try going back on the pill? It's a huge treatment for any kind of gynecological or uterine difficulty. And then it, the campaign is all about bringing awareness to gender equity and access to gendered issues in healthcare. And that's one of the biggest things I saw when I was campaigning for the campaign and like talking to people, is I would say, did you know that these things are covered? Did you know that only the vasectomies are covered? And people would be shocked. They'd be like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. Like, every single person in their lives that they knew who had a uterus was on birth control, and nobody knew that they had to be paying for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And where do you see the biggest inequalities when it comes to healthcare in BC still?
Still, I mean, it's still in all of our, like, marginalized populations. And so, like, women, non-binary folk, trans folk, people of color. In my practice personally, I think a lot of it is the, like, the younger populations who are trying to navigate their way through a healthcare system. So like younger, lower income, there is all of these different systems put in place, but they are really hard to navigate. And again, that was something that through the campaign, people were like, oh, part of this contraception is covered under this kind of program, but to be able to get the funding for it, you had to go through all of these like different windows. I would even call pharmacists and be like, hey, how do you help someone sign up for this like PharmaNet program that helps pay for this? And the pharmacist like didn't even have an idea. So that's something where I feel like often policies get made, but they're not thinking of the people when they do get made, and then the politicians themselves are not that vulnerable population, mm-hmm. and they don't have to go through it.
Yeah.
So something that's really amazing about this new policy is that it's pretty, as far as everything has been laid out, I haven't had to go get a new IUD yet, but as far as it sounds, you just go to the pharmacy and then you access your contraception, which is a mm-hmm. very simple, very accessible. Kudos to the people that made it so easy for all of our vulnerable populations to access this medicine.
Yeah, very easy and also very, very important. And how did you or AccessPC achieve the final step or the final change? How did you get involved with the government and how did you achieve the new law?
For sure. I think a lot of it was just like determination. So in 2020, this policy was mentioned in a lot of campaign promises, and then nothing kind of happened. And so I remember a couple budgets ago being like, oh my gosh, is it going to come out in the budget? And we were all so excited, and then it didn't. We were like, oh, okay, here we go, more work. And so the entire campaign has really just been like a grassroots campaign of getting people to write and contact their MLAs, getting cities on board. That's something that I was really a part of before I got pregnant and had my baby and was a little bit busy, but we got all of the local municipalities, we got like almost every single municipality across BC mm-hmm. to endorse